Let's see what the stew has in store for us today.
Welcome to the Gnomecast, Gnome Stew's tabletop gaming advice podcast. Here we talk with the other gnomes about gaming things to avoid becoming part of the stew, so I guess we'd better be good. This episode is brought to you by our awesome Patreon backers like the astonishing Amadeo Rosa, the dependable Doug Roz, and the kinetic Kathleen Halper. Today, we have myself, Ange, along with Chris and Jared, and we are going to talk about unwinnable scenarios, how to handle them, how to run them, and all the details in between. Before we dive into that topic, though, we're going to ask our Get to Know a Gnome question, which today is, what's a time you were running a game and a problem got solved in an unexpected way that completely took you by surprise? Jared, I'm actually going to start with you.
Okay. When I saw this question, it immediately reminded me of when I was running Marvel Heroic Roleplaying a lot at conventions, and we had someone at the table. We were playing a Young Avengers scenario, and the person that did this was not familiar with Marvel Heroic at all. We explained how the dice pools work and, you know, about stress and complicating, you know, people out of a scenario. And the group came upon a group of guards in this facility that they needed to get into. And he immediately came up with this idea where he built his dice pool by stealing a uniform, running into town, buying sandwiches at the sandwich shop in town, and then putting the sandwiches in the break room and letting them know that the sandwiches were in the break room. And he rolled well enough to push their complication up past the D12 and complicated the guards out of the scene.
Complicated them out of the scene by what? Like by sandwich? Like, oh, these dudes are too full?
No, they all went in the break room. So they were no longer a problem. So everybody could just walk into the facility because the guards all left to go check out the sandwiches.
I'm into it. Like, I love playing Cortex for that reason. I was just wondering what the actual trait on the table was that did that.
I thought for a second you were going to say, I get it. I love sandwiches.
I also love sandwiches. There's nothing more American than slapping something between two pieces of bread and eating it. Throwing it out.
It felt so...
Especially with cheese.
It felt so teenage superhero to me. To have them solve it that way instead of, I'm going to, you know, beat the crap out of all these guards. I loved it. It was great.
Chris, what about you?
Back in the day when I was in my early 20s, if you called me dependable like Doug Rass, I'd be like, that's the best you can do. But now that I'm in my 40s, please just give me dependable all day long. To get back to the actual question. So there was this fight at the end of a story arc in an Eberron campaign that I was running. In fact, it was that... I took the AL campaign that they had put out for Eberron, that I forget what it was called, but it was all in Sharn, and I just used that as the basis for my campaign. And it was actually pretty fun for me to try to work those into like a long campaign adventure and make them feel like a campaign, an ongoing campaign. But they were between the levels of the Towers of Sharn, because there was this black miasma that was sapping life if you were in it, and it was like all over this section of the city. So they had made friends with this orc lady named Mama Garika, who was actually a shaman from like the swamplands of the land that I can't remember. And you probably could pull it out, or Jared that I could better than I could. I forget what that place is called offhand, but she made these lamps that could keep the miasma back, creating like these 5-foot bubbles. So they were like moving their way through this dungeon, trying to keep inside of these 5-foot bubbles of light that they had. So like I actually had like torches matter, because I was annoyed that torches didn't matter in D&D at that point in time. This was like years ago now. Eventually, they were fighting a bunch of aberrations in service to a Delkir, including a beholder. And it was right near the ritual that was creating the miasma. Coming into contact with it, because part of the encounter was like, get rid of the ritual, like do it in the in-betweens of fighting these things because the monsters are terrible and they're hard to kill. Coming in contact with it caused damage, as one of the PCs learned. They were getting pounded by this beholder. They couldn't use their spells because it kept opening its eye in front of them. It was a problem. So then the fighter decided to grab the beholder. I'm like, all right, I guess it's floating. It probably is not very good at like resisting being grabbed and moved around. And she shoved it into the ritual field. I did not expect that. It really hurt the beholder a lot, and they stabbed it a lot more, and then it died. And that really saved the day with that one. And it was out there.
Yeah, I can imagine beholders are not accustomed to being grappled.
Yeah, I was going to say, I found that out in third edition. I had people that realized, oh, the best way to deal with beholders is to grapple them because they can't resist it.
Right? Like, as long as you got somewhere that you can shove them, right? Because if you can't shove them, they're just going to blast you. They're going to eat you and they're going to blast you, right? Like, but if you got somewhere to put them, it's great. Great move. What about you, Ange?
So years ago, I was running a Supers campaign set in Cleveland, and it was a game where, like, superpowers were not really a known thing. So the fact that people were developing these powers was kind of new and unique and what's going on. And I can't remember the logic behind it, but PCs were in a bar and there were a bunch of dude bro frat boy jocks who were kind of being rowdy, making noise. And then all of a sudden, some guys that were kind of a little lurchy started basically fighting with the jocks. And they realized these lurchy guys were actually zombies. Where did these zombies come from? And they very quickly dealt with this fight with the zombies. One of them was completely destroyed. I think a couple of them were completely destroyed, but one was left, but he no longer had any legs. And they're like, well, with everything we've seen, these probably happened because somebody now has powers to make zombies. So how do we find this person to put a stop to them? They're watching as this legless zombie is trying to crawl itself into a particular direction. And somebody goes, I've got an idea. And they found a skateboard, put the zombie's torso on a skateboard, and then let it crawl its way to where its summoner was. I honestly did not expect that. I just expected them to be like, hey, where do you find fresh bodies? Let's go to the cemetery and investigate there. But no, they basically used a zombie on a skateboard as a divining rod.
That's pretty good. That's a pretty good solution. Yeah.
And it turns out that the girl that summoned them had been harassed by those frat boys, so she was just trying to get her due and all of that. So
it sounds like an East Texas University scenario, but it's not a Supers game. But that sounds like something that would have an ETU game.
It very easily could have been an East Texas University scenario. And now you're giving me ideas. So moving on into our main topic.
Main topic.
Let's talk about the Kobayashi Maru. All the Star Trek fans out there are either groaning or looking up with interest. For those that don't know, in Star Trek, the Kobayashi Maru was an infamous test that all Starfleet cadets faced, putting them through a no-win scenario to test their character and how they would handle such a situation. Well, what does that mean for us in our role-playing games? Can you and should you put your characters, your players, through a no-win scenario?
I think you're like, right the first time, characters, because we don't want to put our players in a no-win situation. That sounds like, you know, Squid Game or like Saw movies. We don't want that.
Either way, it's complicated. It's something you can do, but it can lead to some pretty treacherous waters for both you and your players. So let's talk about this. First up is, you know, can we absolutely state one way or another that a Kobayashi Maru scenario is a good thing or a bad thing for a campaign?
Chris? No, it's no. We can't state either way. No, that's it. I got you. Ask the next question. I don't know. Somebody else can answer if they want to. I think it's no.
I also agree it's no. I think you can totally put these in your game, but you need to be prepared for how your players are going to handle it and how they're going to react to it. You can't just throw it in there blind, which is something we'll get to.
The entire reason for questions like this on a show like this is just so that I can quote Star Wars and say, only a Sith deals in absolutes.
There you go. That's fair.
So why would you want to do a Kobayashi Maru or no-win scenario in your game? Jared, you go.
I think it really depends on the scale of what that Kobayashi Maru is going to be. Like, is this a situation they can't win that leads somewhere else? Or are you talking about like the end of the campaign where it's going to, you know, be the end of the series and they have no input into this? And I think all of us can probably agree it's not really great to end somebody's story without having any input from them. But on the other hand, there are all sorts of situations where I think this does work as a transition to another part of the campaign. One of the examples I had is I just did something that I feel that was kind of like a Kobayashi Maru situation where all of you in my Thursday night Midgard game had destroyed an artifact, and because of where and how you destroyed the artifact, a god showed up and then gave you a mission that was a follow-up to that situation. And there wasn't really a lot of, we're going to tell the god no, or banish the god, or fight the god. It was the god showed up and gave you a mission, and now you're going to do the mission. That said, you weren't completely out of the loop in that, and I definitely want to hear your input on this, but you weren't out of the loop on this. This was the consequence of how you chose to destroy the artifact. It wasn't that a god is going to show up now no matter what.
I did not consider that a no-win scenario at all. It was definitely the whole situation with the dragon orb was very complicated and didn't leave us a whole lot of wiggle room on how to properly deal with it. But I did not feel Sagotan showing up and going, hey now, I have a job for you now that you've screwed with my things. I can see how it could be interpreted as such, because it's definitely, the choice we have is to either take on the mission he's asking us to do or suffer greatly because he put a gas on most of us. But I didn't see that one as being a problem.
One, that's consequences and repercussions. There's nothing wrong with consequences and repercussions for characters' choices. Two, you actually gave them a choice. That's fine. It showed character of the characters, right? In my opinion. I heard this story because I edit the other podcast that the story was told. So it's called Taco with Advantage. You should go listen to it. Anyways, the point is they made a choice. Things happened, and they had another choice after that. I don't really think of that as being a no-win situation. I think it's a pretty good example of, like, man, these are not good choices. To that, I will continue on. So here's what I think the truth of the no-win situation is, at least for me. To me, it's not about the obvious victory. Say we're playing a combat-heavy role-playing game, and when you throw something in front of the players and, like, we can't win, they think that it's a no-win situation. But really, the truth of what's happening there is that defeating the opponent or winning in the obvious way is not what that encounter or situation is all about. There's usually some other way to prevail, or at least get a little win, like escaping, learning a lesson, gaining information, like something like that. I think that is the best way to handle the encounter or situational no-win situation. I like Jared's methodology too of, like, if it's a bad choice, like, well, we're going to have to pick one of these bad choices. I like that best when it's a consequence to previous actions.
So I had a game I played at a convention many, many years ago where I sat down to play, and it was some sort of fantasy game. And it started in media res with us having just acquired an artifact from a hag in the swamp, and we had to take this artifact back to the city and give it to the person who had hired us to retrieve it. And we walk in to his building, and we're sent to kind of a parlor, a waiting room area. And as we're sitting there waiting our turn, this other group of adventurers come in, and they are obviously more experienced, more seasoned, more polished. These are the adventurers we want to grow up to be. And they, because they are more experienced, more seasoned, get to go in before us. And we quickly realize, because my character was a seer, and so I could kind of spy on the next room.
I love the story.
That the wizard that had hired us to get this artifact basically took the artifact from them and then eviscerated them. Like, turned the room into a big red mist bubble by destroying these experienced adventurers that were way more powerful than us. Now, what the GM wanted us to do was to take our artifact and run away. The whole adventure was supposed to be us figuring out how to keep this artifact out of the evil wizard's hands and get it to somebody who could help us defeat him. But no, because we had one player who was like, well, it's a game. If we can't beat it, the GM wouldn't put it in front of us. And we had another player who was the, like, evil version of the Rainmaker, who basically kept pushing buttons on that player, and nobody would run away.
Can we talk about this for a second? I think this goes down to this goes to a further question, but I think this is a good example of what talking about, like, how you set these things up and pull them off, right?
Right.
I'm gonna tell a story about a game that I was running not too long ago that I did a similar thing. It's the start of a new story arc. These bad guys show up, and they just wreck base looking for a thing in this town. In fact, the first thing that happens is they run in, the player characters who are all like level 9. They run in, they see, one of them sees their mentor, who is like a level 18 artificer, get run through the back. Like, she gets stabbed right through the back by this giant sword, by this giant Dark Knight who has a bunch of like demonic looking entities with him. Like a team of like 5 people. He pulls the sword out and kicks her on the ground and says, "Give me the key." At that point, I stop the game. I'm like, "All right, look, these people are way stronger than you. You probably can't beat them. If you stay here and fight them, they're going to die. You're all going to die. There are other things that you can do, but that's what's going on right now. Now what do you do?" Now, that's the thing right there, Ange, that you'll probably say, and Jared will probably say, like, when you mentioned earlier, like, explain it, like, throw it out there, talk about it.
Yeah.
That's what you need to do in those situations. Now, in that situation that I'm talking about, they managed to snatch her, the woman that got the artificer, their level 18 artificer, they snatched her, ran away with her, even though one of them got snatched off to the side, he managed to get away too, ran away, escaped, took the key with them to begin with. Eventually, the bad guys, I'm like, the bad guys have a goal. They want something. They're going to get it, and they're not leaving until they do. So they move on. They learn some more stuff about them. Like, they can teleport. They have, like, these shadow teleports in a world that does not have a lot of teleportation available to it. They shadow teleport to one of the other characters' grandmothers. We call her Gammy. She's an alchemist. She speaks with a very southern Creole accent. She's like, "I'm like, this is my grandma, and this is how she talks right now." And one of the other characters always plays her because he has a way better accent than I do. They love this character. So I'm like, "Well, either give me the key or, you know, I'll start murdering people." And they're like, "I don't know if we can trust this guy." I'm like, make your insight check. They made him like, he's pretty honorable. Like, he'll do the thing as long as you give him what he wants and he'll leave. So they gave him the key. She survived and they left. So they got their wins and they learned information and they got a sense for what these people could do. And then the game moved on to the next phase.
Yeah.
Now, that's a no-win situation that I think is worth putting out there, the example for what you do compared to what happened to you.
I think the mistake was that the GM was, I mean, it's, and I think all of us have talked to this to varying degrees on these podcasts we do. There has been an evolution of the style of the way we play and run games. And the GM was very much trying to do that, keep everything in character, you know, keep everything confined to the mechanics of the game, in character of the game. And like, my character was saying, "We should go, we should run." And he kept throwing me bennies because I was doing the thing he wanted everyone to do.
Yep.
And like I said, the one player was, I don't want to call them dumb. That's unfair to them, but they were definitely very, very single-minded and very unwilling to consider that there could be another way to handle this. And there was the player egging them on, you know, being like you could tell that player knew exactly what he was doing. So the GM was just kind of like, he should have taken a moment to stop and be like, "Hey, you guys know you can't beat this. You should run," you know, or basically like, give us, like you said, Chris, give us the lowdown on what's happening so we can have a properly educated choice about what we're doing. But he was running in that older style and not, I mean, this was probably about 14 years ago, so.
Can I make the suggestion for the people that want to keep it in character or in the game?
Mm-hmm.
The players, and I think this is a problem where we talk about that older style, which I don't think a lot of people actually use that older style to their complete, like that immersive style to their complete advantage. Because we didn't always think about what the characters knew. Not what the players knew, but what the characters knew, right? Like, the players are not the characters. The characters are their own thing. They live in the world we don't. So you see these adventurers walk in, and then you hear them all get misted into blood. As a game master, I can be like, you know who those people were. They're all famous. They're all powerful. They defeated a giant red dragon. They did these amazing things, and they all just got melted in about 2 seconds. Like, you all know that because you live in this world. What does that tell you? Like, I mean, the Benny thing is also a good initiator for, like, maybe we should leave because somebody's saying it. But that's just another way to be like, look, man, that's what your character knows. So, like, you can make a choice based on what your character knows about the history of the world.
Yeah, one of the things I always say, regardless of anything, is respect the competency of the characters.
Yep.
The characters probably know more than the players do about the situations they're in. So give them the tools to react properly. So moving on, what do you do when you have a Kirk? I.e. someone that has something they can do that goes against the logic you set up for why the PCs can't win this situation. Oh boy, have I been there and done that with this one. My players are way smarter than I am. Jared, you go.
So I think part of this comes down to how much do they really want to be the Kirk? If they're just doing this, which is kind of like how I see Kirk actually doing this. It's someone told him there's an absolute. Kirk can't deal with the fact that there's an absolute. He didn't expect, you know, not to have this go wrong, honestly, but he wanted to prove that, you know, he could show them, no, it's not really, you know, this isn't really something that you can force me to do. I can screw with the program and have it go through. In some cases, if it's something like that, if somebody just wants to have their moment of rebellion in a big situation that they can't win, if you can gauge that and they're not going to take the entire situation down a different route, then let them have their moment of rebellion. You know, that is literally giving them some player agency in that they can wiggle out of part of what you have set up, which is a little different than if they can completely move out of that situation, because then I think you have to have a bigger talk where it's like, okay, this is why I was doing this, you know? So if you want to go along with it, that's good. If not, then we need to have a talk about where this campaign is going, because this is where I had it planned to go.
For me, this isn't so much about unwinnable situations as setting things up that I think are going to be a challenge to the players, and then having a player be able to just wave their magic character sheet and, oh, I didn't know they could do that, or way, I didn't think they could do that, or I didn't know that they would consider that an option, and I'm much better about it now, but when I was a new GM, oh, all the time, all the time. What are your thoughts on this one, Chris?
So let's talk about this Kirk situation real quick. And let's talk about the difference between tabletop role-playing games and screenplays, right? Screenplays are planned out and written. They have plots and things that have to happen to make stories move along. Kirk knew about the Kobayashi Maru. This was a role-playing game. He already knew about it. It's a famous Starfleet test. He had time to look into it, hack it, and beat it. For Kirk, it wasn't an unwinnable situation. It was a heist that he managed to pull off. It's actually a whole role-playing game session that we never saw. That's my opinion on the Kobayashi Maru situation. When this stuff happens, tends to happen in our tabletop role-playing games, we often don't give our player characters time to plan. If we do, then often they will try to figure it out. And they probably should be able to figure it out. Because letting them plan for something or, like, work on something that they can't actually win seems like a waste of time. It seems like you're disrespecting the player's time and my time as a game master. Like, why did I bother putting that together then for them if they couldn't figure out a way to subvert it? Like, I never want to cliffhanger that thing for, like, a week for them to think about it because it feels bad to me. Other people could like that. I don't know. I'm not at your table. I would suggest that as a good general practice, though, to not do that. But yeah, man, like these situations, they're not supposed to be about winning. They're supposed to be about learning stuff about the characters in the situation, like going forward. That's my opinion.
Yeah.
The irony there too is that from the screenplay standpoint, Kirk getting away with the Kobayashi Maru in context of Wrath of Khan was showing that Kirk someday had to still deal with that situation, no matter how smart he was, because that was when Spock died in order to save all of them.
Yep.
And if I remember correctly, the Kobayashi Maru had been referenced quite a few times in the past? Or was it referenced
I think that was the first time they actually mentioned it.
Okay. At least they talk about it like this is a known thing. About Kirk that everyone should know about his history.
But by the way, Jared's 100% right. Like the whole point of that movie is Kirk learning the lesson of, like, we can't win every situation without losing something. Sometimes you have to make a sacrifice in some way, shape, or form to win. Which Jared's right. That's part of the theme of the movie. Like, it's good call, Jared.
You're not the guy who's going to make the sacrifice play.
That's it's whole. Yeah, I mean that's one of the themes of that movie. Like that's 100% correct.
The franchise.
Yeah, the whole franchise, really.
Just for those playing along that didn't quite follow that, we switched from Star Trek to the MCU. Just so you're aware.
And I made a Star Wars reference earlier. It's all over the place.
It was Avengers, the first Avengers movie, which then resolves when, you know, Iron Man at the very end of Endgame snaps his fingers.
Yep.
Like there you go. There.
He long setup and payoff.
To your point, Chris, about doing a cliffhanger, if you are trying to do a true no-win scenario where they're gonna have to make the hard choice, don't do a cliffhanger right before that. But it is totally viable to do cliffhangers where you give the players time to think about what they're going to be dealing with, so maybe they can come up with a plan. But it's a slightly different thing.
I agree with you. Yeah, if you're going to let them, you know, Batman their way out of it, Batman 66 their way out of it, then that's fine.
Yeah.
I'm just making references now because we can.
Is there a way to do this so it's something you can work through away from the table and then use to set the scene, rather than forcing people to go through the motions of it?
Yes, absolutely. We can just do the thing where, like, everybody's standing around you with their spears pointing at you, and then when we open up the next, that's where we end the session, and then the next session, we open up and you're all in jail. I don't know. Like, that's a pretty classic response to, like, a scene swipe. If you've ever watched a movie or TV show, like, the cut.
Oh, yeah.
Like that is a cliffhanger in a role playing game. We have that all the time. That's just one example, right?
And I think again, speaking to that older, you know, an older style of playing and running, and a fear of taking away the agency of the players, that GMs are afraid to do that type of scene wipe. But it's totally viable. It is totally viable. I have a friend who will, when he's running Mutants and Masterminds, will do that type of thing. And when he does those scene wipes, everyone at the table gets a hero point. It's saying, I know I'm forcing your character into this next situation, but here's a hero point for everyone because we're moving the story along.
Yeah, man, we got mechanics for that these days, right? Numenera's got the intrusion, or I should say Cypher's got the intrusion. You could just give everybody a Benny at a Savage Worlds table. You can give everybody a fate point. It's just a really hard compel at a fate game. You know, all that stuff exists now.
Yeah, speaking of things in universe and when I didn't have tools for things, I had someone at one point in a DC Adventures game, which is Mutants and Masterminds, where I basically just wanted the Flash's Rogues Gallery to escape from them. Yeah, I just wanted them still to be out there. I was you all get a hero point, Mirror Master opens a portal, they all escape. And I had one player like, I don't accept it. That's not the way this is going to go. If I don't accept it, then that doesn't have to happen that way. And at the time, I should have said, this is the way the game goes. And if you don't trust me to frame the scene this way, then we have bigger problems. But at the time, I was like, okay, I guess I'm going to have to let them deny these and have this go this way then. And it was kind of awkward.
I would have just had the Rogues Gallery kick the shit out of them at that point. I'm like, well, I know what these guys' stats are. I'm just going to buff them all up a little bit. And like, you wanted to fight them. Like, I'm still going to have them get away. You might get one or two of them, but most of them are leaving. Like, because you can do that. You're the game master. Who cares? Like,
yeah, but again, there's that you don't want to take away your players' agencies. You know, you want to make sure that they have some engagement and control, and like, yeah, it's like as a GM you need to learn the line for when to do that and when to step back and let them do what they want.
I'm with you, Angela. Like I said, in that situation they wanted to fight, okay, they can fight. I'm just gonna make it really hard on them. Like,
yeah,
I don't know, that's where I'm like, okay, I was giving you the easy way out. Now we're going to go the hard way, and you're not going to like it because I'm going to push all these characters to their max because they don't want to get caught.
So can you create a decision point or objective within the no-win scenario where the PCs can't win? They can't win the big obvious thing, but maybe they can achieve something else?
Why don't you go first, Ange?
Oh, no, don't put this on me.
I'm putting it on you.
I'm throwing this back to Jared.
Oh.
Yes, and since we're going to throw out other media as examples, that is completely what Rogue One was. They were never getting off of that planet, but there was an objective that is for the greater good, and that's what they achieved. Now, granted, I don't necessarily think you want to throw your players in that situation where you're going to be like, okay, you're going to be dead at the end of the situation. But it was very much, this is a subset of things that you can get done. You're not going to do the big thing. You're not going to get, you know, you're not going to defeat the entire empire at this point in time, but this is an important thing to get done.
Oh man, can we talk about this example? Because I like it. I want to talk a little bit more.
Absolutely,
about it.
Talk about it.
I like that. So the big thing is actually getting the plans out, mm-hmm. in my opinion. So I feel like the question is reversed, right? Like, if I'm the game master and that's happening, I'm like, all right, well, you can tell the rebellion about the situation and go in there and maybe do a thing or two and then leave, but you might not get the plans. Or you can go deep in there and you'll probably, I'm pretty sure you'll get the plans, like 80 to 90% sure that based on the roles that you'll get the plans, but you're all probably going to die. There's like a 10% chance that any of you survive. I'm like, and that's the choice that I'm going to give you as the game master. And then I'm like, all right, what do you do? It's the end of the game, so you might as well ride it like you stole it, right? And that's what everybody did in Rogue One. They wrote it like they stole it.
I will say this is one of those things to be careful of with the no-win scenario is you, unless it is something like that specific Rogue One situation, you don't want a TPK. I don't think you want a TPK. You know, I mean, if you want that, I guess go run Cthulhu. But
so my example from way earlier, like, this is one of those things, right? They can't win the big obvious thing, which is stop the bad guy from getting the thing that they want. But they can achieve something else, which was save their mentor, that lady that got stabbed, which they did. And also make sure that there's a minimal amount of damage done to the city that they live in, which they did.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the decision points of the objectives. And I gave them that choice, right? Like Jared said, like giving them those interesting choices is the way to let them get little wins, which I think are important in these kind of situations. And also show something about the characters, what actually truly matters to them.
Right.
It was.
And I mean, you could totally have one player who decides that their character is going to sacrifice themselves to save everyone else. That's a totally viable thing to happen in one of these situations.
I've had that happen before.
May have even happened on a well-known streaming show that I won't spoil in case people haven't been following it, but you know.
Poor FCG.
There was actually an adventure that Fantasy Flight put out for Age of Rebellion, and I liked that they did this, and unfortunately this was for like free RPG day, so it wasn't widely sold. But the whole thing was there was a timer, and you can get X number of things done in this rebel base as you are evacuating. But if the timer ends, Vader shows up and murders you. You don't fight Vader. Vader shows up and murders you. That is in the adventure.
Do you know the timer's coming?
Yes. Yeah, that's the whole point is okay. They're letting you know that the Empire is on its way. So you have to hurry up and, you know, clear the stuff out of this base as well as possible.
Do you know Vader's going to show up?
I don't know that you know Vader's going to show up.
Oh, man. That's terrifying. I feel like there should be like one role when Vader gets there to see if you get away or not. But yeah, I'm with you. Like, come on, man. They got away in Obi-Wan. Like, just use the trick where there's two ships, right? I don't understand why Vader didn't grab the other ship. Anyways, we're just making references to make references.
Oh, yeah.
This is really fun.
No, but I think the point is, like, if you have a clock like that, though, you need to let people know the stakes. Like,
yeah.
You know, yeah. You can't say, there's a clock. What's it for? Not telling you. You can't do that. That's not good.
I mean, you can.
Yeah.
That's a different kind of tension, right?
Yeah.
Jared, like, you ever do that? We used to do this thing at Phil Vecchione, he's one of the gnomes, also misdirected Mark Panda's Talking Games, all that stuff. We used to put this giant die on the table, and we'd start it at 6. We wouldn't say anything. We'd just start counting it down. People like, what's that for? I'm like, I don't know. We'll find out later. I'm like, oh, man. That's a different kind of tension.
So, have you ever felt like you were in a Kobayashi Maru no-win scenario in a game? And what did it do for that game?
I've already answered this question like 3 times. See example that I provided.
I can actually talk about this one. The City of Calls campaign that I regularly talk about on Thaco with Advantage, we were basically dealing with cultists who wanted to have a demonic invasion. Or, demonic invasion. I'm better now about which ones are chaotic and which ones are lawful, but either way, demonic invasion, and we were working really hard to stop it.
God, I hope so. You did a whole episode on it, Ange.
Working really hard to stop it, and we failed. We failed. And I've asked the GM, I'm like, was it going to happen no matter what we did? And he's like, well, it was all based on your choices and where you went, but it wasn't obvious, like, where you needed to go and all of this. And so we did what we thought we should do, and it wasn't enough. And it's been really interesting role-playing kind of the dramatic ramifications of that on these characters who've been trying so hard to be the big damn heroes and stop this from happening. Now they're in a situation where, like, okay, it happened. Let's see if we can stop it from getting worse or at least fix it.
I love that stuff. I love consequences and repercussions to actions. If there are consequences and repercussions, then you can feel bad about things that have happened in the game. If you're always winning, then you're like, we're the best. What are you really struggling with at that point?
I have to confess, as a GM, it is really, really hard for me to put my players in these types of situations. I'm a softie. I don't understand why my players don't know that they can totally just steamroll me, because I am a big old softie. And I hate, I hate putting them in those situations where it's like something bad could really happen. No, it can be fixed at the very end. You just need to be a big damn hero. Go!
Jared, are you going to tell us about zombies now?
Oh, yeah. I think I've mentioned this one before. I was in a Savage World game that was the War of the Dead campaign, in case anyone ever played through it. And every chapter, the end of every chapter, felt like a Kobayashi Maru scenario, because you would get to the point to where, okay, you've gathered all this stuff, you found a place for everyone to stay, the haven has been established, and now a thing happens to destroy the haven, you cannot stop it, the only thing that you're playing through is to see if you survive or not. And over the years, my concept of why this was a bad campaign has shifted, because at the time I was thinking, it's because there were any of these at all that was bad. I now believe that the problem is actually the pacing of it. You didn't have any time to enjoy having the haven, to feel like there was a payoff to anything before it got smashed. It was always, you did all the work, you set up the haven gets smashed. You do all the work, you set up another haven, it gets smashed. You need to give people time. You can't crush someone's spirit unless you give them hope, basically.
See The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think this is one of those points where it's good to understand story structure. Like, at the very beginning, Jared, you mentioned you don't want to do this type of thing as the finale of your campaign, because that's just like like spitting on your players and then boot stomping them. The way the whole story structure works, you get the everything seems the darkest it possibly could for the characters. And then basically, you can get into like rising back up out of that. Chris has probably got all of the actual words about story structure that I'm failing here, but you guys get what I'm saying.
I can tell you the best places to put them. So like, if you have a story arc, and your story arc is like the beginning, the middle, and the end of your story, and it doesn't mean your campaign, that means a story. The opening is a good place to do this. Like, if you're going to do it, you don't have to, but I'm saying that's a good place to do it, right in the middle, because a false defeat is a good place to do it. That's what it's called, the false defeat. And then the third place is all is lost, which is right before the third act starts, or right in the beginning of the third act, where you're like, everything is crap and we don't know what to do anymore because we just got our lunch handed to us. And then, of course, the characters figure out, like, oh, there's a way out of this. And then they, start doing that thing. Like, those are the three places to do it in your story structure, in case anybody was wondering.
Any last thoughts on no-win scenarios before we start heading out of here?
Yeah. Actually, let me talk about that last thing real quick again. What did it do for the game? I know I answered this question a few times, but there's things that it does for the game. So one, it creates enmity between the villains and the PCs. I think that's a good thing. I like when you don't like your villains. When the player characters think they're actually dangerous and scary. For me, a lot of times when I use it, it establishes power level to achieve. So a trick I like to use is in games where you level up is that my villains tend to be a lot stronger than my player characters at that point. but then it gives the PC something to shoot for when you're leveling up, because I don't let the villains level up anymore. Maybe a little bit, but not much. Also, that gave the player characters information. So, like, they know stuff about the bad guys now, and that allows them to strategize for the future and potentially use that information against them. Also, maybe figure out who they are and go learn stuff about them so that they can also find other ways to defeat them. That's, like, the most classic adventure story trope thing for villains ever. And then it gives you chances for the PCs to get little small wins in these situations, which shows the character of the PCs, like what they care about, what matters to them, including they sacrifice themselves and then they die. And then you can, you know, go on that resurrection quest if you want.
So moving on out of here, this show is funded by the Gnome Stew Patreon. You too can Patreon backer by following the Patreon link of the Gnome Stew website to the Gnome Stew Patreon. We love doing this, so our patrons help us keep it going. The Gnomecast is part of the Polygamers Podcast Network. So if you're enjoying us, here's another show to check out.
Pandas Talking Games. Queer gamers talking about tabletop role-playing games and making outtakes. Join Pandas Phil and Senda every other Wednesday, answering listener questions about playing, running, and designing TTRPGs. It's like car talk, but for your games.
You can find all of us at GnomeStew.com, along with GnomeStew on Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, and Threads. Gnomes, is there anything else you want to give a shout-out to today? Jared, go.
If you want to see something that gives people hope and then absolutely crushes their spirit, go watch X-Men 97.
Yes. Yes, have some.
Yeah, I was not prepared. I was not prepared for that show.
Episode 8's not much better.
No.
No.
Yeah, that's all I'm going to say is just, yeah, maybe do that. And then, you know, check out my
zero
blog.
Zero spoilers.
Yeah.
Yeah, zero spoilers. But yeah, man. Was it episode 6? Remember it?
Oh, no, 5. It was, episode 5. That is five. Burned in my five. Brain that it's episode 5.
Yeah, 5 yep. is five is remember it. And then 8 is tolerance is extinction.
Yeah, part 1.
Yeah, I mean, part
yeah,
1.
Three parts so. To this.
Yeah.
It wasn't much better. 8 wasn't much better than 5. I mean, 5 was the worst, but 8 wasn't much better.
Anyway, Chris, you got anything to give a shout out to?
I do. I'm going to pimp some stuff. So John Arcadian, he used to be the head gnome, and he's still one of the gnomes. He has written 3 D&D products called Everyday Magic, Feats and Features, and Items and Armaments, part of our Unlock series for Encoded Designs. These are 5e products that you can put into your games. The Everyday Magic has like 50, over 50 spells that are like everyday utility, non-combat spells. There's custom feats for magic. There's an alternate spell point system in the book so that you can have some flexibility in your spell casting. And more rules and options for integrating Everyday Magic into your game. The Feats and Features is a lot of fun. I like this book a lot. I play tested a bunch of this stuff. It's got like a point system for buying feats and features for your character. So it's a different way to customize your character instead of the feat system that exists in 5th edition. And Items and Armaments has a whole system for building your own personalized gear. So if you like that, it's 50% off. There's a link to the Unlocked Bundle, which then you can get it for like $6.50 instead of $13. So there you go.
And I did a little...
John does a lot of cool stuff with 5e.
I did a little bit of work on Everyday Magic too, so...
Did you? That's cool. I didn't know that.
I don't really have anything to shout out other than Origins is coming up at the middle end of June, and I'm going to be there. So, yeah, there you go. So, do you think we were able to keep out of the stew, or was this a no-win situation where one of us has to go in?
Stop.